Okay, so the title's Dielectric Brains. What I'm really going to be talking about is the dynamics of D brains in non-trivial curved space times. In ordinary Maxwell physics, we're used to the idea of how external fields can polarize systems of charges and how that generates dipoles and other interactions. What I want to describe today is how essentially the same thing happens for D brains, how external fields can polarize D brains to generate quote unquote dipole interactions. This being string theory, of course, there's more dimensions, there's more indices, there's more fields. But it's essentially the same physics. So Dirichlet brains, as originally conceived, were these extended surfaces where open strings stick. And so by imposing some unusual boundary conditions on our open strings, they are confined to move around in some particular P plus one dimensional surface. And if you studied the spectrum, I mean, there's a whole spectrum of open string states. Amongst the zero modes, what you found were a U1 supersymmetric gauge theory. So there were some polarizations parallel to the brains that corresponded to gauge fields. There were some scalars representing fluctuations or motions of the brain in the transverse space, and then the fermionic superpartners. Probably about 5 years now ago, Joe really changed our view of how to think about these objects. And the way we now think of them is stringy supersymmetric solitons that support the Ramond-Ramond charges. And so there's some kind of, depending on the dimension of the brain, it supports some long-range Ramond-Ramond field, and there's a relation between the mass or the mass density or the tension and the charge density on the other side. Being a massive object or massive objects, they're gravitating, and there's a different picture of these Z brains as supergravity solutions, and there's all sorts of interesting physics that results from that. What I'm going to talk about, though, is just the dynamics of the D brains moving around in external fields. And that dynamics is governed by an action that has two parts. The first part is the so-called Born-Enfeld action. That's written here like this. And Rob Lee really showed us that that was the appropriate action to describe the dynamics, if you like, of these individual brains. You can think of it as an infinite series in the field strength, or it captures all orders of the interactions in the field strength as long as the derivatives in that field strength are small. The dynamics of the transverse fluctuations is really hidden in this P, which I'm using to denote the pullback of these various space-time fields. And so if I forget about this part of it, the square root determinant of that pullback, which is just given here, is really giving us just a higher dimensional version of the Nambu-Gatow action. So there's some space-time surface that I'm describing with an internal set of coordinates sigma a, and that, well, this set of derivatives contracted with the space-time field are giving me then what I mean by the pullback that goes into the determinant. What I'm going to do throughout this talk, though, is use the static gauge, which means that I'm going to define the surface or some fiducial world volume for my P brain to be defined in an adapted set of coordinates so that that surface is just given by some set of coordinates, xi, the transverse coordinates equals 0. Then the static gauge, what I do is I match, or I set equal, the space-time coordinates parallel to that surface and these internal coordinates on the brain surface. And then the transverse coordinates then become these fields in the super gauge multiplet. And so in static gauge, this pullback takes this form. And so here's really the kinetic term for these transverse or well, when I stick that up there, that's giving us the kinetic term for these fluctuations. As well as the coupling to gravity here, we also know now that there's the coupling to the Ramon-Ramon fields, and that's really described by the second part, the Chern-Simons action. And so this dp brain is extended in p spatial dimensions, and then there's time, so there's a p plus 1 dimensional world volume, so it naturally couples to a potential that is a p plus 1 form. But Mike Douglas told us that that's not the whole story, that the interaction is actually more complicated. There's this exponential containing this combination of the Cobb-Ramon 2 form and the world volume field strength, so that as well as couplings to this Ramon-Ramon charge, I can also think of there as being couplings to the lower rank forms, or the charges of lower dimensional d-brains. And so if I induce a non-vanishing expectation value on the world volume of this f or this b, I can think of that system as carrying both the standard charge and the charge of a lower dimensional brain, or that this system that combine, or that d-brain with an expectation value for the gauge field, say, is actually a d-brain bound state of those two kinds of brains. So that's the action that I would use for a single d-brain. What I'd like to do is improve on that action now in the first half of the talk, and I'm going to do that using two tools. The first one is the simple idea of t-duality. And the way t-duality acts here is that it has the interesting effect of changing the standard Neumann boundary conditions into a Dirichlet or Dirichlet-like boundary condition. And so this is really how the d-brains were originally uncovered. But so if I do a t-duality in a transverse direction, then a dp brain is extended to a dp plus 1 brain. And so in doing that, I flip one of these scalars, it becomes a gauge field. On the other hand, if I do the t-duality in the world volume direction, I lose a dimension, and I go to p minus 1 brain, and I lose one of the components of my gauge field, and it becomes a transverse scalar. The other more, the remarkable observation of Witten was that when I put together a bunch of d-brains, the sum is more than just, it's bigger than the sum of the parts. Rather, when I take these d-brains, each of which carried a set of U1 gauge theories, I put them all together, what I get is a non-abelian Yang-Mills. And the idea is simply that when these d-brains come close together, there are a lot of extra open string states that come massless, and so they fill out representations of a non-abelian gauge theory. And so the question I'd like to start to try to ask or answer is, how do we incorporate these simple ideas or this simple change from a U1 to a non-abelian UN in the d-brain action? So if I started, say, with the Chern-Simons action, the simplest thing to do is say, well, here I had explicitly the field strength. That field strength should now be my non-abelian gauge field. So I should stick a trace in here over the gauge indices in that exponential term. That's not going to do the trick, though, because in general what I'm thinking about is d-brains moving around in some non-trivial external field. And so these potentials, or these background closed string fields, are going to become then, well, they're functions of the transverse coordinates, and so they're going to become functionals of the non-abelian transverse fields. And so if I introduce a trace, I'd better put that trace around this whole collection of fields, because there are extra implicit non-abelian fields hidden in the background fields appearing there. that by itself isn't quite enough because the pullback as well introduces derivatives of the scalars, and those pullbacks are now naturally written in terms of the non-abelian fields to be consistent with the gauge symmetry. So if I was writing the pullback, say, of the one form, I'd now have a covariant derivative of our non-abelian scalar hidden in there. And so I'd better stick the trace to encompass everything in our Chern-Simons action. And so that really seems like it's exhausted the possibilities, but in fact, that isn't the full answer. And the reason is that you can see that it's inconsistent with the T-duality that I talked about before. And so why is that? Well, recall that when I did T-duality in a world volume direction, that the effect was that I was going to flip one of the components of my gauge field into a transverse scalar. And so if I was thinking about a DP brain and I was writing down some partial action that only, say, involved the gauge field or the gauge field strength, which has now become a non-abelian gauge field strength, when I do this first, when I do a T-duality, say, in the last direction, XP, I go from a P brain down to a P minus 1 brain. There's a lot of components of FAB that don't care about that direction, and so they stay field strengths, but any FAB where one of these indices was that direction P, well, there are going to be derivatives in that P direction, but if I'm doing T-duality and I want that to be a symmetry direction, then I'd better choose a configuration where that derivative vanishes, and then just flipping the gauge field to a scalar gives me then the covariant derivative that I expected. And those are the covariant derivatives then that appear in the pullbacks of the various fields. But then if I do it again, say on the second last direction, I go to a T minus 2 Dirichlet brain. Because I'm talking about a non-abelian field, there are going to be say a P minus one derivative of phi P that is going to have a non-trivial remainder even when this derivative in the P minus one direction is left over. And so after these two T-dualities, I've got these field strengths, I've got the covariant derivatives appearing in the pullbacks, but then there should also be, in various terms, these commutators appearing in the Chern-Simons action. And that, well, that wasn't a part of what I wrote down on the last transparency. So if you go through that operation, the answer at the end of the day is that the Chern-Simons action that's consistent with T-duality takes the following form, where the trace sits out in front of everything, but I've added this one extra piece that an exponential of this I phi, a pair of these I phis. That I phi denotes the interior product in this form language. So if I've got a two form, the interior product with some vector means I just knock off one of these differentials and contract it with the vector. If I do it a second time, well, I knock off the second guy and I contract twice. So when I act with the interior product, I'm reducing the form degree by one in each case. The thing to note in this last case is when I'm acting on forms, because these indices are anti-symmetric, the action of the interior product is anti-symmetric as well. And so in particular, if I take the interior product with respect to a certain vector, when I'm acting on forms, that gives me zero, in essentially the same way that d squares to zero acting on forms. This is when I'm talking about ordinary vectors, i.e. these objects are just collections of numbers. In this particular case, I'm acting with the interior product twice, but I'm acting with a vector that's actually a non-abelian or a matrix-like object. And so when I act twice here with our non-abelian scalars, what I pick up is the commutator of two of these scalars. And so it's because of the non-abelian character of the scalars that I pick up a non-trivial result here. If these were just U1 fields, all of this stuff would go away, and I'd be left with what I had before.
This is what you get from T-duality? Is that how you derive this?
Yeah.
Let's see, so this is an expression before you do the pullback. So, I mean, phis are the transverse oscillations of the brain. Right? So there are different characters under the C's, I mean, the fields you have, which are space-time fields.
Right.
Phis are not fields on space-time, they're properties of the brain. Let's see, but you still need them before the pullback?
Yeah, you do. Well, if you did the pullback, there'd be nothing left to take the interior product with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you look at these components of the field and then pull back.
Yeah, I'm not very satisfied with that, but it's in the same sense that F sitting here in the pullback really isn't a space-time field either, but
sure,
we
overlook it.
Yeah. I guess another thing is that these I's are not only acting here, they're actually acting in the B's. Something you might worry about is, well, here's an exponential of B's, and an exponential, does that mean I can get sort of like infinite number of interior products? And the answer is no. The way you should think of it is I first look at this expression in blue and write it out as a set of forms in 10 dimensions so that contributions of that exponential only go up to some finite order. And then given that collection, I act with this exponential to form a new set of forms, again living in 10 dimensions, and then I do the pullback and I apply the trace there. So as an example of... Nope. Do you want me to? It's hard. The simplest way to do it, or the simplest thing to check, is if you set B equal to zero, then it's actually pretty straightforward to, well, just apply T-duality rules and you can see that it works out. When you have a non-trivial B, the T-duality rules for these Ramon-Ramon potentials become slightly more involved. And I've looked at specific cases, but I haven't, I have to confess, I haven't written this out for the general DP brain and verified T-duality for it. But let's look at a specific case of what I've got there. So let's look at the simplest case, which is the zero brain. And that simplifies life because there's only one space world volume direction, there's no field strength. And so if I simply expand that expression I had before, I get a whole bunch of stuff like this. And if I actually then start to write out, what does this mean? Well, there's the trace over the one form potential, and then I've got the pullback that's coming from here, and then I started writing out this second term, and what you pick out are a three-form term here where I've got a contraction with a commutator, commutator of the phi I two phis, and then there's the pullback of that, or the extra term that comes from the pullback where I introduce as well a covariant derivative and a commutator, and these are all transverse directions. So one of the things we learn is that not only do DP brains couple to the Ramon-Ramon potentials for brains with lower dimension, but you can also see here that they're coupling to the potentials associated with brains of higher dimensions. So in particular, this is the charge that the potential I'd associate with a membrane. And this is essentially the kind of coupling that you would have found, or that rather the matrix model people found by looking at the supersymmetry algebra. Here I've got the membrane potential and this commutator. If I were to think that this was just a constant evaluated at the point where the zero brain is, then I have just the trace of the commutator, and I would have said in this stringy picture that that's equal to zero. The matrix model people had to work harder and say that that commutator was non-zero. But I'm not neglecting this term here because in principle I'm thinking that these D0 brains are moving around in some non-trivial space-time, and so this C is actually then a functional of phis, and so there are extra implicit phis that are buried in that, so that this trace or this contribution to the action isn't necessarily zero. And similarly, you can see in the pullback automatically, because I've got that extra covariant derivative there, that it's not going to be zero.
What happens if you start with, say, 9-grain, where
right.
And then you do reduction.
Yeah. Yeah, you'll start to generate all these pieces because of the T-duality on all the... You wouldn't have any phis, but you've got lots of field strength sitting there in the action.
You get similar commutators, you get...
Right. Yeah, well, that's essentially what I was showing you before, that as soon as you write down F, as soon as you do more than two T-dualities, these commutators automatically come out of that operation. So I can also use T-duality to construct a non-abelian version of the Born-Enfeld action. There's just a set of rules you go through, and I refer you to this interesting physics reports here in case you want to look those up. In this case, what happens is that single determinant you had before turns into you have to split it into two different determinants, and there's this extra structure Q, or this extra matrix Q that appears, and that Q is essentially the thing that carries all of these commutators. So there's an extra determinant of Q that sits out in front, and Q is also hidden in this piece, which was just the standard Born-Enfeld action. When we didn't include the commutator terms. This is essentially the same form that Arcady wrote down for flat space before, but there's an extra cancellation so that disappears or cancels something in there. I guess the other comment is that if I'm talking about flat space, the usual non-abelian potential for these scalars is actually coming then from this determinant of Q that sits out in front. I've also added here an S in front of that trace to denote symmetrized trace. This big expression here has lots of different non-abelian fields sitting around in it, and you're allowed to be confused about exactly how those fields are supposed to be ordered when you're taking the trace. You were allowed to be confused about how the fields were ordered on the last transparency as well, but since no one asked, I don't have to address that question. In this case, essentially what I'm doing is applying Arcady symmetrized trace, which is saying that, you keep the non-trivial commutators, but all these blocks, like this commutator here, or an F, or a covariant derivative of phi, you essentially symmetrize those under the non-abelian trace. That doesn't quite complete the prescription for the trace, because it doesn't tell you what I'm supposed to do with the non-abelian fields that are hidden, say, in these background fields. But what I'll say at this point is just that I also treat each of these components of the field as blocks that are symmetrized in those traces.
So you're saying G is a single matrix, or you're saying there's something symmetrized within G?
Well, it turns out you symmetrize in G anyway, but you also symmetrize that block of things with, say, an F that appears in the same interaction.
So the fact that that G symmetrizes, it just so happens that way, but your rule is, as far as symmetry operations are concerned, is that G is a single matrix. It's not a composite matrix.
No, all I said is that, well, that may have been what I said. What I meant to say was that that object, I treat in the manipulations I do in deriving that, I treat it as an object that commutes with all of the other objects, these Fs, these field strengths.
But E commutes with F even though E has matrix structure.
That's right. In the same sense that you treat F as a commuting object under the symmetrized trace.
So it's a single matrix object that uses
some
of all.
Right. Yeah. I'll have more to say about the trace prescription later on. At this point, though, the thing I wanted to say is that we know that if I go to flat space, that prescription works for F squared. It also gives us the correct stringy corrections at order F to the fourth, but you need to change the prescription or you need to add extra corrections at order F to the sixth. And so I don't expect this to be any better. I expect that you're going to need corrections at higher orders, but you can still think of this as a mnemonic or a way of encoding the information for those leading order terms that appear in the string theory.
In the flat case, what is the status of the
If I go to flat space, and let's forget about the commutators, let's say we're doing the nine brain, if I take the Born-Infeld action, I do an expansion, there's terms of order F squared and F to the fourth. Those are the same as in string theory. At order F to the sixth, though, I know that I haven't got the right set of interactions, and so I'd have to change that trace prescription at that order. It's not known. Well, it's known and it isn't known. I mean, I guess Bacchus and Penn have written down order F to the sixth corrections to your action, but I don't think they've ever published it, and I don't know why. So some consistency checks for these actions that I've been writing down. Well, there's this discussion about how you get stringy. Well, it's right to order F to the fourth in the Born-Enfeld. There's some general arguments that Mike Douglas put forward. Essentially, if you think about string scattering amplitudes, we're looking at disk amplitudes. And so, well, if you just think about how those amplitudes are calculated, they have to appear with a single trace. So, for example, you wouldn't split up those actions that I wrote down and say that the dependence, the background dependence of the closed string fields only depends on the U1 component of, say, the scalar. You can also look at explicit string scattering amplitudes, and there are various amplitudes that I've looked at with Mohamed Gharouzi. And there you can start to see that the background fields are really functionals of these non-abelian scalars, that those non-abelian scalars really are the things that appear in the pullbacks in just the way that that action says. And if you look at this last one, you can start to see some of these covariant, or you can, well, you can start to see these commutator terms arising. Although after all the work that you put into that, you're actually only picking out a single commutator term in that, say, the Chern-Simons action. Another thing we can do is we can look at the results of matrix theory. Waddy Taylor and Mark Van Ramsdonk have taken the results of matrix theory, the interactions of the D0 brains described there, and translated them into the linear couplings of closed string fields to D0 brains in the type 2A string theory. And so I can compare, or you can compare, that D0 brain action that I wrote down to the results that they have here in their paper. And again, you find agreement between the two calculations. That's...
They said symmetrization with respect to...
Right, yeah, okay. So let's... I'll describe that in a little more detail then. So for example, if I look at the coupling to the D4 brain charge, or the potential, the 5-form potential, in the zero brain action, there's a term then that looks like this with these implicit commutators here. There's also a bunch of nonlinear terms where I've got a C5 and a B, but I'm not going to be able to compare that with their calculations because they're only looking at linear interactions. If I write out then what I've exactly got here, essentially I've got CT and then 4 transverse indices contracted with 2 commutators, and then there's the pullback term where I also replace that T by a covariant derivative of one of the scalars. These C's are still functionals of the background fields or the transverse scalars. So what do I mean? I mean that I should think of that as writing down some expression like this. So essentially what I'm saying is that I can split up the space-time coordinates into the world volume coordinates, which for a D0 brain is just T, and so it gets distinguished here in these calculations, and all of the transverse coordinates. And I can do a, given some background field, I can do a Taylor series expansion of that field in all of these transverse coordinates. And then the functional that appears here is just that Taylor series expansion where I replace my standard space-time coordinates by these non-abelian fields. And so it's because in that Taylor series expansion those derivatives are all commuting that you naturally symmetrize those phis appearing there, which is why I said that to you that you naturally get a symmetrization in those background fields. That's the same prescription that I'm thinking of when you, well, think about the background fields in the other cases. So how did Waddy and Mark write down that result? Well, they wrote down essentially that same expression. They had all of these derivatives coupling to some current where that current carried the indices of the potential and then a second set of indices that denoted these derivatives here. And what that current was a symmetrized trace of some basic current that you write down. So that's some expression constructed out of covariant derivatives, commutators, and they also had the fermions running around. And then there are transverse scalars, and I'm supposed to symmetrize all of these scalars with all of these blocks that appear in that basic current there. And if I ask what is, what explicitly are these basic currents, they write out some expressions. They expect that their calculations are only good to order f to the fourth, or that becomes z to the fourth here. in their notation. So for the time transverse directions, I pick up two commutators plus permutations. They also have fermion pieces. For the current with only spatial indices, there's two expressions they write down. The second one here is essentially that time derivative with two commutators and permutations, fermions and corrections. So if I look at these two, those are essentially the same thing that I've got here and here. So there, well, this T-dual action is matching then matrix model result. So some comments on that. One is they worked a lot harder than I did in that they kept track of all the fermions. They also provided me with a trace prescription, which is the one then that I'll suggest I should have adopted in that previous case, which is that anywhere I see field strengths or structures like that, I should completely symmetrize between those and the phis appearing in the background fields. So we can adopt that prescription that the matrix model gives us. Their calculations also suggest orders at which the various interactions might be corrected by higher order commutators. The other comment is that I said that these expressions agree with the expressions I had from the T-dual action. Well, they agree if this term over here vanishes. If you ask what is that term, or you ask in their paper what do they have for that term, they say, I don't know. That current, or this object, is essentially a current associated with the transverse five brain, and they don't know what to write down for that current. So in some sense, the T-dual action is making a prediction for what that transverse current is. It's equal to zero. There's another current that's associated with the transverse five brain, which also has to be equal to zero, because essentially what that's saying is there's no coupling in my T-dual action of the D0 brain to the dual potential, the dual of the two-form Nivo-Schwartz field. I'm not sure how seriously you should really take that answer. I mean, we know that D0 brains do get related to Nivo-Schwartz 5 brains by various dualities, but inevitably you have to do an S-duality, so a strong to weak coupling duality. Essentially, I would interpret that answer as saying that that current has to be some non-perturbative expression, that you will never see that current in perturbative calculations. The other subtlety is that in matrix theory, you want to take a large N limit as well, and there may be extra subtleties involved with taking a large N limit. But at finite N, in string theory, you're not going to see those currents, or you're not going to see the transverse five brains.
What do you actually know in that calculation? More than just non-limitation by four terms with various reductions, with scalars and
No, I think that's essentially, I mean.
On top of that, they just look at what particular happens to what particular gravity field, and they compare to string gravity. So for me, it looks like it's not more than a quotient plus the information about the sample, which is more or less what you say, looking at what
Well, I guess the fact that it's agreeing with the T2L action isn't that much of a surprise, but at least it's a consistency check that everybody's doing, getting the same answer. Okay, so now that I have some actions, I can think about these D brains or collections of D brains moving around in external fields. So the standard flat, when we're talking about flat space, the standard potential that we think about for our non-abelian scalars is this quartic potential. And the stationary points that we usually think about are just commuting matrices. And if I diagonalize those matrices, then the eigenvalues correspond to the positions of various D brains. And the fact that I get these diagonal matrices with arbitrary eigenvalues is just a reflection of the fact that parallel DP brains, they can sit at equilibrium at arbitrary positions with respect to each other because the forces cancel. However, what we saw in this in these actions is that when I think about there being non-trivial background fields, I get all sorts of new scalar terms or new potential terms, and so we can think about finding new stationary points in the external fields. So a cartoon of how this is going to work, where cartoon means I'm throwing away all the indices, is I've got a potential that in some sense looks like a phi to the fourth potential. So that would just be this here, and it would have a single stationary point phi equals zero. When I move the D brains or I turn on an external field, that could induce a phi cubed term in the potential. And so independent of what the sign is, I know that there's going to be some kind of dip in the potential now. And so that this old stationary point now becomes unstable, and the stable vacuum is now sitting here at, well, in this particular case, phi equals f, some non-vanishing value of phi. So this is going to be the real, the stationary point of interest. The fact that the expectation value of phi is not equal to zero in this new vacuum means that in the D brain action, I'm going to induce a new coupling to the field which generated this F term, the external field that generated that F term originally. And that's going to be then the, what I'm calling the dipole coupling of this new configuration.
Rob, do you interpret this as the brain spreading out, that they're now not really on top of each other, but they're sort of have something to find
out with? It's sort of, yeah. We'll see in a second. I'll do an example with indices. So consider a bunch of D0 brains, and I'm going to put them in a background with a constant F4, so that's the field strength associated with this three-form or this membrane potential. This isn't a self-consistent background, but this is just to illustrate the point. The interaction that we had in this souped-up Chern-Simons term for the D0 brain to my three-form took this form here, and so if I start writing that out, what you get is, in my Taylor expansion, is the potential evaluated at the zero brain times the trace of the commutator. For finite n, I'm just going to set that equal to zero. But then there's going to be the first term in the Taylor expansion that's going to have three phis. There's also going to be the term from the pullback that's going to have a time derivative of a phi. And then there, in principle, are lots of higher order terms from, doing the Taylor series expansions of those two terms. The thing to do here is integrate by parts in T and put that time derivative on this particular background field. And if you do that and you assemble all the components, what it turns out is you've got the trace of 3 phi contracted with the field strength of that potential. And that's a good thing. You expected that, you know, whatever the physics is here, that it should depend on some gauge invariant object, and so that's going to be the field strength. These higher derivative terms are going to be involve derivatives of that field strength, and so since I decided that I'm going to pick a background where it's just a constant, those higher derivative terms or these higher terms I can neglect. The full potential for my phis now, I'm going to take the standard term that I had, and I'm going to add to it this term arising from the external field. So I've got phi to the fourth and phi cubed. For my background, then, I'm going to choose...
Is that an I there?
This is an eye here, yeah.
That's a magnet?
No. I mean, my conventions for these are Hermitian matrices, and it works out. I'm just going to pick three spacetime directions, x, y, z, and I'm going to say that there's some x, y, z in time, and I'm going to say that there's some field strength pointing in those directions. And I'm just going to have some coefficient that I'm going to call 2f, and it's convenient just to write it with this epsilon symbol. There's also anti-symmetrizations in the t, but, I don't care about that. And all the other components I'm just going to set equal to 0. So if I take that, plug it in to my potential, and then ask what the stationary points are, what I find is, this equation reduces to this. So one set of solutions to that potential are the old solutions, the commuting matrices, because I've got a commutator in both expressions. So if that's equal to 0, that's a non-trivial stationary point. And if I evaluate the potential at that point, the potential is equal to 0. There's a new set of solutions that I can think of where I take phi times some constant proportional to some representation or a set of matrices here that give me some representation of an SU2 algebra. And it turns out that if I take an irreducible n by n representation for these matrices, then trace phi squared is given by that expression here. And if I evaluate the potential I had, that I get this answer here, where miraculously all sorts of factors of pi and normalizations have reappeared where I've been ignoring them before. But the main point is there's a minus sign here, and so the potential at this new vacuum is lower than the potential at the commutating for the commuting matrices. There's also lots of in-between solutions where I can take reducible representations or trivial representations, but they're all going to have a negative potential, but that's going to lie between this 0 and this negative value that I get for the irreducible representation.
So
one way to think about what the physics is going to be is that you could start with these D0 brains all spread out like this, but that they would wander around, and if they bump into each other, they condense out into various stationary points, and ultimately you might expect that they land at this stationary point where they've all condensed out. And Joe has a question.
Everything you're doing is an effect description when the commutator is fairly small, right? You don't, for example, Born-in cells is valid when the field strength is arbitrarily large as long as it's constant. But you wouldn't expect, I think, maybe I'm wrong, that this would be a good effect description when the commutator is very low. It would be interesting.
For this calculation that isn't consistent anyway, because the background isn't consistent, I'm thinking of small.
Why is that? You mean because it's small?
Well, the background fields just don't satisfy any equations of motion.
Okay. I think when the commutator is very large, probably what it's most going through really is a two-brain. In this case, it's a circle. So it
probably does.
And you can analyze it from the other. Probably can analyze it from the
you
other.
Probably can. And if you'll wait, you'll see that.
I'm sorry.
But the other comment, which comes on the second to last transparency, is you might hope for better things if you looked at a self-consistent background, where in fact you've also got supersymmetry, because we've seen that in supersymmetric configurations the Born-Ehrenfeld seems to capture more than you might expect. Anyway, so what is this? So we had these D brains, they bump into each other, they condense out into something else. What is this thing that it condenses out into? Well, it's something which respects the rotational invariance in X, Y, and Z. And it's also something that where the trace of phi squared, which is a transverse displacement, is non-vanishing. And so you can think that what I've got here is now that this external field has polarized these D0 brains to produce a spherical membrane-like object. And you can calculate the radius of that by looking at the trace of phi squared, summing over the I, taking square root, and throwing in lots of normalization factors. And the answer turns out to be this radius here, which I'm going to call R naught. But then for finite n, I mean, the full formula actually has a square root of 1 over n squared in there as well. And you can also compare, in the context of matrix theory, similar solutions were looked at, although they weren't talking about background fields, but they were talking about spherically symmetric D0, well, membranes. And so there's a discussion that's very parallel to what I have. I guess the other comment was, so we've got an external field, it blows up the D0 brains into some kind of extended object, but then the last part of the dielectric effect or story was that in a new solution, the trace of phi, these three phis, is not equal to zero. And so if I go back to that interaction that I wrote down before, this trace is non-vanishing, and so this object has a non-trivial coupling to this field strength. So it's saying that there's some kind of D2 brain-like object hidden in there. And in this particular case, before, well, as well as that trace being non-vanishing, there are going to be lots of other higher order traces that are non-vanishing, and so there are going to be higher order couplings to derivatives of F that are going to be non-trivial. If you actually evaluate this now for, this was the n by n irreducible representation, you get an answer that you can write like that. So there's an integral along the D0 brain world line, an FT XYZ, and then there's some coefficient here involving R0 cubed. And again, n squared. And so that's what I'll call the dipole coupling for this spherical object. Now, as what Joe suggested, maybe we can think about this in a dual picture. And so let's do that. Let's think about a D2 brain in a background where there's a constant F4. And the question is, can we find a stable, static, spherically symmetric configuration? So here's the action. Since I'm talking about a D2 brain, which is smooth, I go to polar coordinates. That's the handiest way to do it. And my static gauge is now time. And the two spatial directions I'm going to choose to be the angles on a sphere. And ultimately, I'm going to be looking for a trial solution that's just going to be R equals a constant. To go to the polar coordinates, I should switch my field strength and write it down in terms of a potential. So there's some potential that I plug in here. And I thought this was the calculation to do, where I just think about D2 brains. But in fact, you get the wrong answer. If I look at the potential, so here's the Born-Infeld term, it's going like the area R squared, and then there's a cubic term coming from the background field. This isn't what I wanted. I mean, it goes up and then it turns over and comes down. So there is an unstable point here at some large value of R, but the stable point really seems to be here at R equals zero. So in some sense, this Chern-Simons term or contribution is going like phi or r cubed the way we thought it should, but I'm getting an r squared here, not an r to the fourth coming from the Born-Infeld action. And the reason this didn't work is what I had before wasn't just a membrane, it was a membrane D0 brain bound state. It was a D2 brain, but it was made out of D0 brain. So there is D0 brain charge hidden in there. And so what I should think about is not this problem that I posed here, but I should introduce a non-vanishing field strength on the D2 brain at the same time to describe this D2, D0 bound state. And so if I choose a field strength like this with some coefficient n, and it's just going like the volume form on the D2 brain, on my spherical D2 brain. This is just a quick calculation that says well, I can look at how that couples to the potential for a zero brain, and it turns out that that n really is the n that counts the number of D0 brains. This, if you keep track of all the normalizations, you get a term that's proportional to the integral along t of the one-form potential, like that. So that n is counting then the number of D0 charges that are that have been melted into this smooth brain. If I revise the calculation, then I've got an extra contribution to the determinant, and so now it's the square root of r to the fourth plus some term coming from the zero brain charge. And if I think about small r, I can expand that, and I get a contribution that looks like this. So now I'm getting this r to the fourth that I was looking for. I've got the r cubed that I had before, and my potential then starts here. There's an unstable bit at zero, and it dips down before going up. And that potential, or that minimum, sits at, if you keep track of all the pi's and everything, it sits at this radius here, which is precisely that R0 that appeared in our previous calculation. I can also look at, given a membrane that's sitting at some finite radius, I can look at the coupling to the three form, the effective coupling that's left over, and what you find is precisely this kind of dipole coupling we had before, with this factor being the same as that factor that I pointed out before. And so both of these answers agree up to a correction of order 1 over n squared with the D0 brain calculation.
So is this supposed to be valid for log n?
To get some kind of agreement, I guess you would want to go to large n.
However, r naught has to be small.
Right, but I've got a parameter f that I can play with here, and I mean, r is small compared to something with the square root of n and the string scale, and if I play with the parameters, there's enough freedom to make. So as Joe suggested, there is an agreement between these two.
There's an overlapping, it seems like there's an overlapping range of validity.
To tell you the truth, I haven't convinced myself, but there's nice answers suggest there is. One last comment on that is that I said that there were these dipole couplings. I had a background F4, and there's this induced dipole coupling to that field strength. If I have this trace for those three phis being non-zero, it actually induces other couplings. For example, I talked about the higher derivative couplings in the field strength. But there's also a coupling to the Ramond-Ramond two-form coming from the Born-Infeld action. If you look at the determinant of Q, there's essentially a coupling between B and a commutator like that. And if you play the same game of expanding out, you get a coupling to the field strength, H, and the trace of three phis. And so there's some kind of coupling like that. And again, this is because what I'm talking about is not just a spherical membrane, but a spherical D2, D0 bound state. And you should have expected that there's also going to be some dipoles or induced couplings for this field strength. If you look at the solutions for these, well, in the planar case for these bound states, you do see that there's some kind of short-range B field. And from the dual picture, there's a coupling of B to the field strength that arises in the Born-Infeld term. And so there's a coupling that arises there when you're at finite radius. So that's actually just a test case, which is essentially as far as things go right now. You might consider doing more interesting situations, though, where you have a self-consistent background. If you want to hope to get beyond small commutators, you might also think about SUSY or supersymmetric configurations. So a candidate to think about is a D1 brain sitting orthogonal to a D3 brain. So let the D3 brain generate a background and look at the field theory on the D string. And what you can find is a solution that now again goes like these SU2 generators, but the coefficient depends on how far away I am from the D3 brains, and that radial dependence grows as I get closer to the D3 brain. So the D string is then blowing up with a 2-sphere, and the 2-sphere grows as you go down towards the D3 brain. So that's very reminiscent of the picture then of these bions, where you're looking in the dual picture and you've got a 3-brain surface that then grows out in a spike. But the details for that will have to wait. And so one last transparency is that you can use T-duality to construct these interesting D-brain actions, including lots of non-abelian scalar potentials, and those potentials then seem to produce interesting dynamics for these D-brains in external fields. And that's where we quit.
So in the Abelian case, we have an action which is valid for arbitrarily strong, arbitrarily F with no derivative.
Right.
In the non-Abelian case, I gather that's not true, right? You could keep talking about these F to the 6
directions
and stuff. So the action you write down, and I guess an earlier one by RPD, should be true, do just as sort of valid for, in terms of F to the 4.
Yeah, in general.
Well, there is an interesting point about what Rob was discussing. Commutators of F may be small, but the commutators of X or Phi may not be small. So that expression is actually valid in the case of commutators of F or Phi are not small. But commutators of F or
Yeah, but in the solution, for instance, that I looked at, if you took the commutator of two commutators, that's not necessarily small. So.